Denise Oliver Velez, welcome to Tell a Friend.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to invite you here because you are most famously known for being a member of the Young Lords, which was a radical organization that spurred from the city of Chicago. And the group was involved in advocating community rights and also protecting the rights of Puerto Ricans in America. And I was wondering, to begin with, could you talk to me and my audience about some of the social conditions that led to the formation of the Young Lords?
The Puerto Rican community, and I have to say right up front that a third of the organization was either African American or mixed, meaning coming from a family where one parent was Puerto Rican, one parent was African American or Cuban or Dominican, though the emphasis was on organizing in the Puerto Rican community. In fact, in Chicago, where the Young Lords were founded, the button that they had expressing solidarity with Puerto Rico was designed by a Mexican-American member of the organization. But it's true, the focus was Puerto Rico, both Puerto Rico, Puerto Ricans in the diaspora, particularly in cities that had large Puerto Rican populations. And then there was also an emphasis on taking a look at the conditions in Puerto Rico, which even to this day, and that was 50 years ago or more, most people are still extremely confused about and don't understand the United States' role in colonialism. You probably have a better perspective getting an education in Great Britain, given England's colonial history, but for the most part, people are amazed if you bring Puerto Rico up at all and you say something about it being a colony, and they go, no, this is US territory. That's how it's obfuscated. And they did a poll a couple of years ago, I think it was the New York Times, and probably over 50% of people in the United States had no idea that Puerto Ricans are American citizens. So you have ill education, which was one of the things that I think we wanted to address. The conditions were extremely bad for a majority of Puerto Ricans who were pushed into migrating to the United States. It wasn't just sort of, you get up in the morning and go, oh, it'll be so nice, I'm gonna move over to the United States. They were forced off of the land, forced off of massive plantations. The land distribution efforts for peasants didn't work very well. And when you had the advent of World War II, there was a need for factory workers. Unemployment was extremely high on the island. So there was, I guess you'd call it a pressured migration. They originally called it the Marine Tiger Migration. Two parts of the United States, and specifically a large settlement in New York, into areas that had already been previously occupied by other waves of migration. And quote unquote, the ghetto. Really bad housing situation, tenement buildings, essentially. And those people that had jobs were factory workers or piece workers, piecework workers doing sewing and things like that, or working for the war industries. And given that a large number of the people that came over here were also not white. In how people define whiteness here within the United States, they were settled in neighborhoods that already had African-American populations. And it's complicated because It's you're talking about a nationality or an ethnicity, as you know, Latino, Latina, Hispanic. Nowadays, the word that young people are using is Latinx, but it doesn't mean that there isn't raciation on the island, that there isn't racism there. And so you had Puerto Ricans moving into neighborhoods where they were in close contact with a lot of Black Americans. And there were tensions and there were friction, but there was also a considerable amount of solidarity. And so one of the primary issues, I think, other than housing and the situation of the tenement buildings that people were moving into, was in a broader sense, health issues. And nowadays we use the terms like environmental justice, but we didn't have that language then. But if you're living in facilities that are roach infested, rat infested, where the hospital system is murderous, where you have, Puerto Ricans have the highest rate of asthma in the world. And so you've got a bunch of factors coming together. And though we didn't set out to say, okay, we're going to address health issues, you know, or we're looking for at the environment, it was more a sense of talking to people in the community and getting them to identify what they saw as problems, rather than coming in and imposing some kind of fantasy leftist agenda on a population. I have a problem with groups on the left that talk at people rather than with people in the community. And I think one of the good things we did was identify what people in the community saw as their primary issues that needed to be dealt with. And then we figured out a way to organize around them and always attach an agenda with an action that you could get people involved with. So I don't know whether that sets the scene appropriately, but that's kind of where it was. And when you look at the term young lords, we were pretty young. I mean, we had members in the organization who were 14 and 15 years old. I think the average age was around 17. I mean, I was elderly at 20 and 21. Our youngest full lord was Augie, and he was 12 years old. So we also had some older members of the community who showed up and joined as well. So I'm not saying it was exclusively young people, but I see a parallel to the kinds of movements that are being driven by young people today with the massive Black Lives Matter protests.
And could you talk to me a little bit about your childhood and how you ended up becoming part of the Young Lords? Because there must have been a process. You don't just join a radical organization. What was the internal dialogue going on in your mind whilst you had all of these social political factors playing out?
I'm always getting accused of being Puerto Rican, and I have to say to people that I have not one drop of Latino or Latina ancestry at all. And it gets even more confused because my husband is a Black Puerto Rican, so I have tacked on to Denise Oliver as Velez. And I grew up in not in a typical household, I would think. My father was a fellow traveler. The friends of my parents were all members of either the Communist Party or the Socialist Party when I was growing up. So the political environment in my home was extremely progressive, extremely left. And I actually you know, young people are always extremely critical of adults around them. So I was like, communists are so boring. You know, all they do is sit around and discuss the internationals and who's a Trotskyist and who's this and that and the other. So I resisted this idea of a very sort of academic Marxist-Leninist environment. I mean, and this is very well-meaning and it's very progressive, but I want it to be more action, you know, more stuff. So, and my parents never had a problem with my activism. I did my first sit-in in the third grade, and they made us, they handed out dog tags for little kids to wear in school because the Russians were going to bomb America, and it would be a way for children, dead bodies to be identified when the Russians bombed people. And they made you get under your desks, you know, to hide from the bomb. So two little girls in my class and I, both of whom were also from families that were part of the left, we refused to get under our desks and protested. And I was in the third grade. And then I got in trouble and my parents came up to school and they were very angry for me getting into trouble because they didn't think you should be giving little kids dog tags, you know, to predict their deaths. So I got taken to things at 11 and 12 years old and joined several organizations early on. First, my local NAACP youth group. And then got involved with CORE and a group called How You Act in Harlem, and got exposed as a high school student to the blossoming Black arts movement in Harlem. Things with, at that time, it was Leroy Jones who became Imamu Amiri Baraka and others. I was working as a waitress in a coffee shop in Harlem where all of the Black intelligentsia hung out, you know. And when you're a teenager, you're like really excited, like, oh my God, you know. And I used to wait on this very nice gentleman who always had a cup of tea. And he used to sit with a martial artist who was very well known, Chaka Zulu, and they would play chess. And at that time, there was factionalism within the Black movement, determination of who's Blacker than whom. And Blackness began to be related to one's complexion, rather than even one's ideology. It was a sort of strain of cultural nationalism that had happened at that time. And there was a brother, I am not going to name him, who was an extremist on that level. And he used to come into the truth and mess with me as a waitress. And he would order something, he would say, I didn't order that, take it back, bitch. And I mean, really aggressively nasty. And this was upsetting to me because here I am, you know, in Harlem and I'm doing my thing and this man is picking on me. And it got to the point where every time he came in, I cringed. And at one point I snapped because I've never been known to bite my tongue. I've always been pretty assertive. And he said, this chili isn't hot enough. You need to test this. And I said, test it yourself. And I dumped it in his lap. At which point he ran out of the truth and he came back with a gun to shoot me. And came in, pointed the gun right up in my face. And I was freaked out. It was really frightening because he was seriously going to shoot me. He was screaming, half-breed bitches, get out of Harlem. Well, first place, I'm not a half-breed anything, and I'm not a bitch anything. And all of a sudden, a gentleman got up and walked right in front of the gun and informed him, my brother, Blackness has nothing to do with the color of one's skin. And the guy turned gray. He's looking at this man and And he spun around and ran out. I ran back into the kitchen and grabbed the owner because I was shaking, you know. And I asked the owner, whose name was Teddy, like, who is that man, that the nice man that orders tea every day, who jumped in front of the gun? Because actually, I thought that Chaka Zulu, the martial artist, would be the person who would get up to stop the situation. And the owner looked at me and he said, Denise, you don't know Minister Malcolm? And I looked and I said, that's Minister Malcolm? I had no idea. I had been waiting on Malcolm X.
That's an incredible story.
I was floored because I knew about Malcolm X, but I had never gone to the temple. So I made my business to attend. You know, the first time I went, I showed up in jeans and they wouldn't let me in. And the second time I went to the mosque, it was, as is true in many things that have to do with Islam, it was sort of segregated, separated. Women were on one side and men on another. And I was raised to be a very staunch feminist, and I decided that that particular thing was not for me. Though I continued to follow Malcolm and his movement away from the Nation of Islam and to support him. But I had no interest in becoming Muslim.
So your membership within the Lords, was that, can you pinpoint it to a date?
No, because it's sort of organic, okay. I left, right after, about a year after that, I went to college and I had the opportunity to spend a day. I was going to a white university in New York City, Hunter College, and I had the opportunity to spend a day with Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer and travel around New York with her. And it changed my entire worldview. I had been too young to join the Freedom Rides. My parents wouldn't let me go. I was 15 and it was like, they were like, no, no, no. So spending time with Miss Fannie Lou and understanding the incredible strength of this woman who was willing to die for the right to vote and was almost killed made me decide that I wanted to go to a black school. And I informed my parents I was going to transfer to Howard University, which I did. And my mother said, if you don't get a scholarship, you're not going. So I got a scholarship and I went down there. And Howard was in a point of transition at that time. And though an HBCU, historically black college university, it was headed up by a president that was pretty conservative, and students were beginning to demand a true black university. And one of the students engaged in that effort was an architecture student who was Puerto Rican, a black Puerto Rican, big fro. And I became friends with him, Harry Quintana, and his wife. And because he knew I was from New York and had familiarity with the Puerto Rican community, because I have friends that grew up in the barrio is Spanish Harlem, he announced to me that there were some Puerto Ricans coming to visit DC. And since I was probably one of the only people that knew anything about dealing with Puerto Ricans, he asked me if some of them could stay at my apartment. And they did. And they were kind of shocked when they saw my apartment. I had a big shotgun propped up by the door to shoot rats, essentially, but to keep burglars out. And they were kind of taken aback. And they said to me, if you come to New York, we have a job for you, if you ever come to New York. And I left Howard after a student takeover. We shut the school down. And I came back to New York, and I got a job with them. And they sent me to work. They were building a prep school for high school dropouts in East Harlem, El Barrio. So I moved into a tenement building that they were going to be renovating and started teaching at the prep school. And a confluence of people came together there. It was called the Real Great Society, RGS. And we started having meetings, and then several of us were recruited to go to an experimental college on Long Island. And that was where a group of us came together, a political group. There were not enough people there to have a Black caucus and a Latino caucus and an Asian caucus, so we became the non-white caucus. And two brothers, one who was Puerto Rican and one who was African American, had visited the Black Panther office in New York, and they came back with a newspaper, and in it was an article about the Young Lords in Chicago. And they were, wow, you know, this is really cool. And they got one of the school, a car. They were going to drive to Chicago to go meet Chacha Jimenez, who was the head of the Young Lords in Chicago. And those of us who were women said, we're not getting in the car with you and driving to Chicago because y'all are crazy. So it was actually only brothers that went to Chicago, met with Chacha. And when they came back, it was like they were now the New York Young Lords. It was, they got the blessings of Chacha. And some of the students started going into the city on a regular basis. They hooked up with some other brothers who were in a street gang or former street gang. And the Young Lords evolved. And some of us made the decision to, it's very hard to split your time between campus and hands-on daily activism. So ultimately, it became a decision to make. You were either going to be a Young Lord full time, or you were going to stay on campus. And I'm one of the people that decided to be a Young Lord full time. So it's not like there's this organization that you're watching and you decide, I'm going to go join it. It's like I said, it was an organic process. And the only major decision was, do I finish school or do I dedicate myself to community work with the Lords? And when you joined the Lords, you couldn't have a job. Similar to the Panthers, it's full-time membership. We used to say it's 25 hours a day, because it was. So that's what happened.
And once you were in the organization, could you talk to me about the role you played within it? Because am I right in saying you were the first senior woman in the organization?
Senior in terms of, we were organized with a paramilitary structure. We adopted that internal organization from what the Panthers had. So we had a central committee. And then you had ministries with people that were the head of each, like the information ministry, the health ministry, the defense ministry, the education ministry. And when in the initial period of time, the central committee was all male. And in fact, even the, I guess you'd call them non-commissioned officers, like sergeants, were male too. The officer of the day was a key sort of sergeant position. And they were in charge of giving people instructions about what they had to go do. They also could hand out discipline, and there was strict discipline in the group. So when I first got there, they were like, oh, well, Denise, how about you be like a secretary or something? And I looked at them, I was like, excuse me, I don't type. And so I said, I think that guy over there can type, why not get him? And there was a problem with the guy that they had who had been officer of the day. So they turned around and made me OD. And that meant that I had a little bit of power, not central committee level, but I could hand out discipline. So if Central Committee members showed up late, I gave them discipline. I didn't care that they were being weak. And I have never been known to keep my mouth shut. So I was very assertive about what I did. I also had a background as an art major, so I started working, helping edit the newspaper that we put out, Palante, which was our primary source of income. And as things continued to progress, there were problems that were internal that had to do with the machismo of brothers in the organization. And we started holding women's caucus meetings in my the apartment that I lived with two of the other sisters. And it ultimately resulted in pressuring, first place, the program and platform of the organization had a segment that talked about machismo being revolutionary, you know, and we found that to be an oxymoron because there is no way in hell that machismo can ever be revolutionary. It's oppressive. So it's like saying revolutionary racism, you know. And we put up a list of demands. We demanded that the program be changed. We demanded that women take on higher level positions in all of the ministries. There had been some incidents that had taken place, and we demanded that the entire Central Committee be demoted for a period of time. And that happened. And who stood with us, interestingly enough, were a lot of the younger brothers in the organization. They were used to working with women. They were side by side with us every day. So we won those demands, and I was the first woman appointed to be on the Central Committee. And then later there was another, but that's how that came about.
And I want to focus on this intersectionalism, which I have picked up on when I've been reading about the Young Lords. The Young Lords were not only interested in dealing with issues of race or issues of sexism, but they took an intersectional approach to all of this. Why was that important for the organization at the time? Because we see that with the Black Panther movement as well. There was this intersectionalism.
In some ways, we were more intersectional than even the Black Panther Party, I would say. And I was familiar with both because we worked hand in hand in New York City, in many instances organizing jointly with the Panthers around formation of certain kinds of movements. I think this is going to sound crazy, but it's not like we learned this from a book. And in fact, it's probably better that we were not doctrinaire anything. We borrowed from somebody would come in and we'd have a PE class, that's political education class, and they say, I read such and such, and we'd sit around and absorb it. And we were looking at things from the Caribbean, we were looking at things from African intellectuals, Latin American intellectuals, and we were also dealing with day-to-day experiences. And in a funny kind of way, we weren't locked into one specific politic. We borrowed and pasted things together. And what the end result was is what you would call intersectional today. But we didn't have a handbook. Things that made sense, we did. Things that didn't work, for the most part, we removed. So when people say, well, you were all a group of Marxists, and I would say, well, not exactly. Or you were a Maoist. Well, not exactly. Well, you were a culturalist. No. And we were grappling, I think part of it had to do with, again, a majority of people not having had long-term experience in other political groups. We made it up as we went along. And I know that doesn't sound, you know, particularly woke, of us. But that's how it worked. And so when we were confronted with addressing the fact that some of the members of the organization came out as gay, we didn't freak out. We just dealt with it. We said, okay, we should have a gay and lesbian caucus and keep on stepping. And it didn't require, and was there resistance? Yes, but there's resistance anytime you bring new ideas into anything. So when we looked at issues like, okay, a lot of left organizations are class-based. Their entire ideology is founded on, you know, class struggle, class warfare, whatever. We didn't find that that worked well in a situation that we were also coping with the dire impact of racism against Puerto Ricans, but within the Puerto Rican community. So we were probably the first group in the United States to begin to address some of that internalized racism and the damage it had done, and also the external racism that was coming from both the rulership of the colony and in the United States. And so when I look at some of the things like the Combahee Collective's work, developing things around intersectionalism and identity politics, we were already addressing those kind of issues. But again, we didn't have jargon to attach to it or nice, neat package name. We just knew that we had to deal with that it wasn't always an issue of class. We're looking at race, we're looking at a lot of other kinds of issues as well. And we did the best we could with what we had. And going out every day, we had to sell 100 newspapers a day. We had to sustain ourselves in the organization, and we had police repression. That was an external problem, as well as some of the negative effects of our COINTELPRO, not as tragically as what happened to the Black Panther Party at that time.
Now, I want to backtrack just a little bit and look at the fact that you said that there were a lot of African-American members within the Young Lords, and you had this close relationship with the Black Panther Party. Did you adopt the idea of political blackness at the time? So this is the idea that if you weren't white, you can create an anti-racist coalition together. Is that something you adopted as a group?
Not really. We were working in coalition with a number of different white elements. At the time, I don't even think that that was a primary problem for us. One, because of the health work we were doing, we formed very strong ties with a group of progressive political doctors who were primarily white at both Metropolitan Hospital and Lincoln Hospital. We hooked up with some young white folks from Youth Against War and Fascism, a group called the RIP Collective, which we joined forces with to take over the Randall's Island Pop Festival. We had relationships with, I don't know how I should put this, Juan Gonzalez, who was our Minister of Education and later took over another position, had come out of the Columbia University struggle with some of the original members of SDS, and later some of those people became the Weather Underground. And we had feelings of solidarity with some of those underground tribes that were doing certain kinds of things at the time. We were above ground, they were underground, and they were white. and primarily women. The Panthers had a much more extensive network because they had the National Committees to Combat Fascism, which were white groups, as well as the nascent group, the group that came out of the Rainbow Coalition, which was the Patriot Party or Young Patriots, Preacher Man and Turco, out of that original Rainbow Coalition. But we were not really hooked up with them because that was something that was generated out of Chicago. I think that Cha-Cha has a much better perspective on that because they were part of that original group that Fred Hampton formed. We weren't, except by, well, Pablo spent time there with them in Chicago. But were we, as you had groups that were coming up as a much more sort of cultural nationalist definition of themselves and essentially looking at everything in a black and white kind of way, white people bad, that was never where, but remember that you have a large portion of the Puerto Rican community self-identifies as white for a whole host of historical reasons. So we were patching together, fighting the racism, but at the same time, identifying the culture as being more Afro-Taino or Taino-Afro, but not being able to excise that European Spaniard influence. I mean, speaking Spanish, for crying out loud. So it's a complex thing to address. And I think that we had a different position than organizations on the island. And that had a lot to do with it being generated out of the mainland. And later that would play out in the schisms that developed and the destruction of the Young Lords was when the decision was made to take a large segment of the organization and move it to Puerto Rico, which is a decision that I voted against. And when the final vote was tallied and the decision was made to move a lot of the cadre to the island, I quit. I walked across town. It was a very short walk to the Panther office and join the Panther Party. And working with people I had already been working with for years anyway. So it was a kind of natural transition for me because of the fact that we had already done a lot of work together.
Now, earlier you mentioned the police repression that happened at the time. Could you talk to me a bit more about the Young Lords' relationship with the police, but also with super state structures? So I've been looking at the British Black Panther movement, and there was a lot of secret surveillance at the time. And I was wondering, what was your relationship with both the police and the state?
We were originally luckier than some other organizations, mainly because those of us who formed, and I can only speak for New York, I can't speak for what was going on in Chicago. Because of the close ties of those of us who ultimately became leadership that predated the organization's foundation, we knew each other. And so it wasn't as if they could send in an outside person to all of a sudden, you know, come in. We were pretty safe in that respect. I don't know whether I've ever told this before. My cousin who lived in the barrio, who was not in the Young Lords, was dating a cop. And a brother, you know, cop. And he, because he supported what the young Lawrence and the Panthers were doing, let her know, like, he wanted to have a conversation out away from their office. And he and a fellow police officer informed us that they were sending new recruits out of John Jay, which is the police college, to infiltrate the organization. And they gave us a description of who these dudes were going to be. And sure enough, like clockwork, 2 days later, these two guys showed up, you know, right on, power to the people, you know, to join. But we already knew they were cops. And instead of saying, no, you can't join, we have information that you're the police, we said, oh, sure, fine. You know, we have a long period of initiation. You have to do a lot of street work. And we gave them posters and flyers and buckets of paste and sent them up to the Bronx to paste up flyers every day and kept an eye on them. And we figured that if we kick them out, it would be, you know, the two cops that were giving us this information may not be around and be able to identify who the next two recruits were going to be. And over a period of time at that time, we got more information about some other people who were being sent to infiltrate the organization. We were very lucky, again, because we were much closer knit. We didn't expand as rapidly. The Panthers had offices in, you know, all over the city and all over the country. And so we could keep some of that down. Ultimately, they were successful in, I believe, influencing what happened with leadership later on. And that's a very long and complicated story that I'm not going to get into. But we had confrontations with them on a weekly basis, whether it was at demonstrations or being harassed, busted. A lot of hard jobs, the money. As Minister of Finance, dealing with the money, but also as the liaison to our attorneys and dealing with having to get people bailed out. One of the things that really bogs organizations down, if you're constantly being harassed, if you're constantly having people picked up, if you're constantly having to provide money for things like bail, luckily we didn't have to pay for attorneys. But that was one of the things that ultimately created a lot of problems for the Black Panther Party. The amount of bail money that was being required for members of the New York 21, for example, who were accused of, they were going to blow off the botanical gardens, or, you know, it was cockamamie crap that was invented by the Red Squad and COINTELPRO. So it's a drain when you constantly have to, you know, organizations, we often don't think about radical organizations and how they fund themselves. And because if you're a member 24 hours a day, you also have to be housed. You also have to be fed. It's not like you go to your job and show up once a week for a nice meeting somewhere. And that's really a strain, particularly as you expand and you need more and more money to sustain that kind of expansion. And we were expanding to places like New Jersey, New Haven, Connecticut, Boston. And as the police clamped down more frequently, the pressures escalated. So you have that, and then you also have the psychological impact of when you start spreading suspicions of infiltration, it creates tensions among cadre, among officers, because you start to develop a level of paranoia, which is really not paranoid because it's happening, but who it's happening with, who's a cop, who's not, you know. And you have factionalism that can develop, which can also mean starting to point fingers at people who are not a cop, but who's somebody who disagrees with you politically in that kind of political debate. And that's harmful too. It's an insidious worm that is used to destroy solidarity. So there's that. And I think we don't talk about that enough.
So there you just mentioned infiltration in the group. But one thing I'm interested in hearing from you is, were there people within the Young Lords that you suspected of being informants? So not being police, but people who were within the movement who were being paid to hand over information?
Again, we knew that we had some because we knew they were sent. We got a description before they showed up. Were there others? Yes, there was that suspicion, and in some cases it proved to be true. In other cases it proved to be not true. And there's the rub. Because if you start wielding, this is an informer, this is an informer, this is an informer at people, and if you're wrong, again, it creates tensions and conflict and paranoia. Now, in some cases, it's right. So, again, we did not suffer on the same level that the Black Panther Party did. I to this day, feel that Fred Hampton was assassinated specifically because he was capable of pulling together that Rainbow Coalition, about which not enough is said. People identify Jesse Jackson as the founder of Rainbow Push. Fred Hampton said, "I am a revolutionary." Jesse Jackson said, "I am somebody." There's a difference.
And I was wondering, was the organization international looking? Did you have links with British radical groups and South American radical groups, or was it centrally focused on North?
No, first place, in newspaper, we tried to include as much information as possible about other struggles going on around the world. And in our own PE classes, political education classes, we were reading things from the Tupamaros. We were reading things, historical pieces about the formations that were coming together in the Antilles, the Greater Antilles, and those kind of movements. We were looking at things that were going on in Africa. Not so much Europe at that time. We were really stunned when Bernadine Dorn showed up in Harlem, and she was given the keys to New York City, and she brought them up to a meeting that we had all night in the Panther office with the Young Lords there, and we learned about the struggles going on in Ireland. And because before then, you know, IRA, what do we know about that? And we started doing political education. We met with, you had Iwar Kun in New York, Most Righteous Harmonious Fist, which was an Asian organization. And we started through those associations. Plus we had a member of the Young Lords, Huey, who had been raised in Chinatown. And we started to look at struggles that were going on in Asia. It wasn't, I don't think we had much of a sense at all of England as a place that had Black people in it. And there was, we read some of the writings that were coming out of the Caribbean. And of course we read Fanon. But a sense of what was actually going on in places like Brixton, I don't remember us ever having a political education class about it. And I was not exposed to it until later.
And I wanted to move on to talking about your iconic iconography and your fashion, because when I look back at pictures of yourself and other members of the Young Lords, you have a very iconic look. You know, the berets, the, you know, you have this militancy about your costume. And was that something that you purposely worked around, or how did that all come about?
Well, I mean, I never thought of this being iconic. All right. The Panthers had berets. You've seen the pictures, you know, and I mean, Eldridge's classic seating Huey in that wicker chair and putting him with the spear. That was Eldridge who did that, who had a great sense of what worked in terms of image and communicating messages, sometimes that were just not even verbal, you know, because he had that sense. So by the time we were formed, the Panthers already had the berets and the black leather jackets and whatever. Well, we adopted the berets. We could not afford the black leather jackets. And we ended up sort of with army jackets and whatever we could pull out of the free clothing drive. People donated stuff to us, and we didn't have any money to shop for clothes. So if something showed up in the free clothing drive that fit you, you just took it out of the box. But you dressed for comfort. Not every lord. When we went out to march in the streets, we were there with the berets, with the army jackets, and whatever. Go left, go right now. Pick up the gun. But did we consciously sit down and decide we're going to have an iconic image? No. I think what made a difference was also that for the first time in the Puerto Rican community, you were seeing people that had big froze. And I was one of the big froed sisters. But we also had brothers with big froze. Not all Puerto Ricans have hair that makes it into a fro. Some of them have straight hair. But lots of people had hair that had been straightened, and we talked about in the community, you had this sense of pelo malo, bad hair, means kinky hair, right? And pelo bueno is hair with waves. Dead hair, pelo muerto, is if you had hair that resembled hair from indigenous people. So the only good hair to have was, good hair was European wavy hair, you know, and you had the other two ends, dead and bad. And we eradicated that. So I would say that inspired a whole generation of younger people who had parents that were having their hair processed and burned and whatever, to adopt that image, if that's what you mean in terms of iconic look. It was a radical look in the community that at that time. The same way that earlier, I'd say, in the Black community, it was a similar kind of impact in Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, and you know, Power to the People and the Fros. And I assume that you had probably similar kinds of things that took place in England.
Yeah, in Britain, we see a lot of the American iconography making its move. And a lot of the people I've spoken to are very forward about it. They say that they took direct inspiration from the Black Panthers in America. So when it came to the black outfits, when it came to, you know, the black power fist, when it came to the books they were reading, all of it was being inspired by the American movement. But I wanted to turn our conversation to looking at the end of the Young Lords. And in your assessment, what would you say led to the eventual demise of the organization?
I've said it sort of already. I believe, and I think I have nowadays, I have agreement from some of my former comrades, because we've had discussions about this. I believe that the decision to leave the base and move to the island was the beginning of the end. And for a number of reasons, I mean, as a person who's been an organizer for a very, very, very long time, I will say to you, don't ever abandon your base. You leave your base and you're cut off, you know, at the knees. So we had made several exploratory trips to Puerto Rico. And one of them, Pablo Yoruba Guzman, and I were on with one other person. Went first when we got to Puerto Rico and we were staying at the other person's aunt's house. The lady was chasing me around with a straightening comb, telling me I couldn't go out in the street with my hair like that. She kept telling me, you have a straight nose and your skin is fair enough, but that hair, you know, and I was kind of like, wow. We then went to meet with the leadership of the Puerto Rican left. At that time, it was, it's now called the Puerto Rican Socialist Party, but at that time it was Movimiento Pro Independencia, MFA, MPI. And our first introduction to the head honchos was in a sort of cocktail party gathering in Isla Verde, which is high-rise condominiums and stuff. So we go to this meeting with the left, the powerful left in Puerto Rico, and we walk in, and it's me, Pablo, and the other woman. And Pablo's in a black leather jacket and with the big fro, and there's me, you know, with a huge fro. And the woman who was with us, Gloria, she just looked like what they call típica boricua. She had straight hair and whatever, but it was the two of us were supposed to be the presenters. They looked at Pablo like he had two heads. I mean, the hostility was like, they turned around and they stared at us and looked at us, and I was supposed to speak. So I got up and I first started speaking in Spanish to address the group. And then I said, I'm now going to shift into English, pardon me, but since Spanish is not my native language, my apologies, but I prefer to continue in English. And somebody shouted out, that's what's wrong with you New Yorkans. You don't speak Spanish. And New Yorkan, meaning New York Puerto Ricans. Now this is a gathering of the left. So I was kind of like, I said, excuse me, I'm not Puerto Rican. That's what's wrong with you New Yorkans. And I said, wait a minute, you know, stop. I said, I am not Puerto Rican at all. No tengo ni un chipitín de sangre boricua. I don't have one drop of Puerto Rican heritage. I said, I'm black. That's what's wrong with you. And I had to go back. And then they were shouting out to me, ¿y tu abuela? You know, and your grandparents. And I'm like, none of them. My family was African American. They were enslaved in Virginia, blah, 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 blah. And I went, I had to go through this whole ancestry.com thing, you know. And they finally got it. Like, oh, were screaming at her because, not because of her Spanish being bad or her being a New York Puerto Rican or running this black thing. You know, she really is one of them. By that time, Pablo was ready to just, you know. And the only black people we saw in the room there, not the leadership, not the cadres from these organizations, were the maids serving hors d'oeuvres. Okay. They then assigned us to the person who, within the structure of MFA, which is now the Socialist Party, who is the head of the youth. That's a position that you'll find in a lot of socialist organizations, because when I was in the Congo, they had a person who was the head of Le Jeunesse, you know. So the youth leader was assigned to us because we were these, you know, strange young people from New York. And he said, well, where would you like to go? Who would you like to meet in Selma? So we told him we wanted to go to, the first place we wanted to go was to see Don Pedro Arizu Campos' grave. And we knew that that was on the roadway that went into, we wanted to go into La Pella. La Pella is, oh, I guess, anybody who's seen the video Despacito has seen pictures of La Pella. It's very poor. It's very rough, but no poorer or rougher than the neighborhoods we were organizing in the South Bronx or in the Barrio. And we had people in the organization in New York who had family in La Pella. So we wanted to go like where, you know, street people were. The guy who's the head of the youth movement for the socialist group turned white. He was like, La Pella, La Pella. Do you want to go into La Pella? It's too dangerous. And we were like, what? This is the revolutionary group here in Puerto Rico? You know, like whatever. So we insisted we want to go into La Pella. We made him drive us down the roadway into La Pella. We got out of the car. He slammed the door shut, locked it, and rolled up the windows. Petrified. We, of course, being young, you know, it's kind of raggedy looking, and whenever we walked over to some people, yo, we're from New York. Do anybody know Julio? His family is from the South Bronx. And people came out of their houses. Hola, Gota, come on in. You know, we slapped and fived. They're looking at our froze like, wow, that's so cool. And they invited us into their homes. They gave us stuff to drink. We had coffee. We didn't get murdered. We had a wonderful time, and we left this fool sitting still in the car. And because, I mean, if you're afraid to go into La Pella, you'd be afraid to walk on the streets in the South Bronx. And that was our first introduction to the elite of the Puerto Rican left. We had several other incidents while we were there. And so when we came back to New York to report on our trip to the rest of the Central Committee, Pablo and I were very negative. We said, listen, they got their own organizations over there. We will have solidarity for independence for Puerto Rico, but they already have structures, and those structures are not going to be very welcoming to a group of kids from New York, a third of whom don't speak Spanish. Another third who speaks some Spanglish, but nobody read it or wrote it. And 80% of the population on the island does not speak English. So there were all these reasons that we presented for why it was not a good idea. But there were counter arguments given about going to Puerto Rico. And ultimately, the vote was taken. And they decided to go. Like I said, see ya, hasta la vista. I'm walking across town during the Panthers. But I kept an eye on things. And people in the community were devastated. I would run into people in the street and they say, ¿Dónde están los llanuros? Where do they go? You know, ¿qué pasa? And I said, pa Puerto Rico. So when they got there, they were confronted with a lot of things. One, to support yourselves with a newspaper that's in primarily in English, so just trying to put out a newspaper there in Spanish was very difficult. They were butting heads with organizations that were already there. People were not prepared for them to be presenting the way they presented. I'm not saying that they were completely rejected, because that's not true, but within a very short period of time, a majority of the people that had gone to Puerto Rico quit the organization. They were then castigated publicly, said they must be agents, they're this, they're that, whatever. And they weren't. They were hardworking cadre who couldn't cope with the situation that was going down. It got more and more negative. When they finally abandoned those efforts in Puerto Rico, they came back to the States. And by that time, they had adopted a Maoist agenda, and due to the influences of somebody who at this point in time people are questioning where that person was coming from as an agent, as a whatever, but they reorganized themselves as the Puerto Rican Revolutionary Workers Organization. They were no longer the Young Lords. They pulled everyone out of the organizing they were doing in various aspects of the community to go work in factories, to become working classized, whatever. You know, so work that you're doing, organizing mothers or doing, you know, hospital things or whatever, all to the factories you go. You know, I was no longer part of it, but I was watching it from a distance going, oh shit, this, you know, but I had nothing to do with it at that time except observe. And decline progressed, and ultimately it turned into some rather ugly kinds of things that took place at the very end, but that was the end. Years later, I talked to some of the people who had been part of the decision to make that move, and they said to me, you're right. You know, you were actually right a long time ago. We shouldn't have done it. And I'm like, whatever, you know, you can't go back and fix it. I hope that sometimes young people today like to take on sort of the heroes of the past, revolutionary stuff, you know, the images are really influential. What they really need to examine is how, where we fucked up. I'm sorry.
Yes,
where we? I'm allowed to say that? Okay. It's so important to look at things that did not work. You need to examine why they didn't work. You can't take things that were done in the past and just force them on top of current conditions. One is because change is always happening. And what may have worked in 1970 doesn't necessarily work in 2020. But some of the things that were wrong then are still wrong today. I think what worked, some of the things that worked for us at a time, and we had incredible support in our community, regular folk, I'm talking about, you know, not people who come to discuss the different levels of Marxism, and I'm talking about regular folks in the community, and we learned that we had to talk to people. We were talking to people's grandmothers. We were talking to people who were not actively engaged politically, and we learned to take a lot of that rhetoric and put it off to the side. I think that in many ways, sometimes we have academicized too much our movements. And that's a form of elitism that I don't think that we're addressing today. We have to be very, very careful about not creating these gaps between where we are as movement people and where the people who are moving are, because they won't move. If we move ourselves too far away. And I have two friends that I call up whenever I'm worried about, am I getting too sedity, you know? I call two friends of mine up and I talk to them, and both of them are two of the most grounded in the community people I have ever met in my life. And they will tell me right up front, "Nah, Denise, that sounds too bougie. That's some bullshit, you know, break it down." And I'm not known for being somebody that sounds particularly intellectual anyway. Even the students I had used to freak out in class because I talk to them the same way I'm talking to you right now. But you always have to have a way of checking if you have outdistanced. If you're too far out in front of the people, you're going to turn around and go like this, and they ain't going to have your back. They will not. And that's where we often make our mistakes. Yeah, I'm sorry. I went on and on.
No. I think that is a great point you make, because when I was speaking with Beverly Bryan, who is a British Black Panther, and then she moved on to other group, she said the exact same thing. Because I fall into the trap of looking at people like yourself and thinking, oh, wasn't it great back then? And she said to me, you also have to appreciate the casualties of the movement. Some people never recovered from the records that they got during the time, never got over some of the disagreements. And I think it is important, like you said, to look at it holistically and not get caught up in the academic ideologies of the movement.
So yeah, can I interrupt you? I'm sorry, because she's so right on with that. We have, okay, you have all these people out in the streets right now, Black Lives Matter, and talking about with posters of George Floyd, you know, who's died, say her name, say his name. Who's out there saying the names of people who have been incarcerated now for 50 years, who are still sitting locked up? And I defy most of the people out there to even name any of the, it's almost all brothers, you know, one or two sisters, who, there are no defense funds from them, nobody's trying to, you know, petition, and there are some small groups that have been dedicated to those issues, but by and large, they're completely ignored. And I was yelling at somebody the other day on Twitter, you know, they were talking about stuff as if it was 150 years ago. I said, excuse me, I'm not dead, you know? And if I can remember stuff and I'm alive, I'm very blessed, I'm not dead, I'm not in prison, you know? I still have most of my health, but I know too many people who don't. And those names, silence. And that, is probably the harshest critique I have. They have allowed people to be erased. They talk about prison abolition, you know, restorative justice, blah, blah, they throw all this rhetoric around, but they aren't doing shit for those brothers who've been sitting there rotting in prison. And that's sad.
So I want to move on to asking you, how would you sum up the legacy of the Young Lords? And do you believe that a movement like the Young Lords could be formed today?
Oh, sure. I mean, movements are formed by five or six people who get together and decide to do it. You know, I had students say to me, so what grants did you get? And I was like, what? Excuse me? You know, you're funding grants. And so I was like, no, you don't get it. You know, or they always look so perplexed. How do you start something like this? Get four or five of your friends and just go do it. It's that simple. It isn't all that complicated. What is our legacy? Quite a lot of things. I would say quite a lot of things in a much more limited geographical area than you could say for the Panther Party, because again, the Panther Party was national. In the East Coast, where we were, every hospital has a patient's bill of rights posted these days. You go in, and hospitals even have ombudsperson, you know, for patient relations. That hospital bill of rights came out of the work that we put in with Health Revolutionary Movement. And that's important at a time when healthcare is one of the major issues up for debate here in the US, and I assume it is in Britain too, because you have complicated problems with your National Health Service, right?
Yeah.
So we mandate, because of the work that we did testing every kid in the barrio for lead poisoning, there was an awareness raised and laws passed to force landlords to remediate lead paint in their buildings. And we have another issue with it in public housing right now. And we're going to have to revitalize that movement. But prior to that, no one was dealing with that. We forced hospitals to be closed. We're also raising consciousness around issues like the sterilization of a third of the women on the island and issues that are related to women's health, in particular maternal health issues, which again is coming to the forefront these days. I would say that we challenged some of the orthodoxy around issues of race and racism in the community, though I see it coming up now. It's beginning to be addressed again on the island, which I think is good. I think we did much better in New York and here on the mainland dealing with that. The island is still a work in progress. So we made some concrete gains. We put mainland Puerto Ricans on the map as a political entity. I think, though, our legacy and our story still has not been told in the way that the Panther story has been told. But again, we're a smaller group, so I don't expect a whole lot. But it's starting to get out there. You're helping a lot. And the same way that I feel more of us over here have to be faulted for our US centrism. And whenever I have brought up the Black Panthers in England, people look at me like I've lost my mind. What are you talking about? They didn't have any Panthers in. Yes, it did. I said, I bring up the ones in Israel too. And people are going to shock. I find that I blog, so I have been following things that have been going on in Britain with Windrush and whatever, and posting a lot of it. And every time I do it, people go, wow, I didn't know there were Black people in Britain. I'm like, hello, you know, But then they barely know anything about the Caribbean either, because they don't pay a lot of attention. There's this real kind of information elitism and arrogance that just, you know, Black people in the United States are the be-all and end-all. And that's miseducation, and I think it's purposeful, because the more you create senses of international solidarity, the stronger you are. So the ties that have cut us off from each other have to be bridged. And it's difficult. Our educational system is so bad here. I remember even, you have a young, well, he's not so young anymore, I guess, poet person, Akala.
Akala, yes.
And I wrote about him like maybe 2 years ago or something, and people were like, wow, where is he from? I said, I was born in England. You know. Really? You mean he's not like a Rasta Bob Marley? And I was kind of like, you know, no, I'm saying, I don't understand. I'm 72 years old. If I can figure out who Akala is, young people who have iPhones and all this other cool stuff and Google should be able to find things. And I'm not...
I do have to say, though, in defense of America, it's not just an issue over there. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to learn about the British Black Panthers over here, but it took me going to university to find out.
So, really?
Yes.
It was never in school?
No, never. We don't learn Black history in the UK. I went throughout my education not really understanding that there was any racial struggle over here. So I would say it's a collective failure. We learn a lot about Malcolm X, we learn a lot about Dr. King, nothing about Althea Jones, nothing about Darkest Howe. It's just omitted.
Okay, well then it's a purposeful whitewashing to keep your brain subdued on confronting issues that you... What about stuff like Windrush?
Windrush has only gotten attention since the scandal broke, and the attention, I was speaking to a commentator recently, and she suggested that some of this might be, like a guilt trip where, oh, we made a mistake, let's keep talking about everything that they've done. But before 2018, you rarely heard about Windrush in the depths that we hear about it now. So I would say there's a collective failing on everyone's part about not knowing about the movements all around the world and decentering it away from centers such as New York, California, London. I think it's so important to learn about Israel and about India with the Dalit Panthers.
Mm-hmm. The whole issue of Dalits, and I mean, my own sort of academic curiosities and interests are shaped by the fact that what I taught until I retired last year was anthropology. So I'm trying to look at cultures around the world, whether it's Maori culture or whether it's the multiplicity of cultures in places like India. And so I work hard at trying to at least dabble, you know, expose myself, but I have a driving interest in that. And I've been stunned at my incoming freshman students when I would find out, you know, the extent of what they don't learn in high school is sad. And even universities tend to shunt people off if you're not in Black Studies program. You know, that's sort of like the little academic ghetto to shove people into. If you don't take Black Studies, or if you don't, as a feminist, if you don't take women's studies, it's not part of what should be, a good liberal arts education and exposure. And I don't know how to correct that. But again, I didn't have to get stuff in school. I had parents that were making sure I had a certain level of education about history and culture. But two, just to have the driving curiosity, they're not teaching you shit in school. Go find it out someplace else. And that should be one of the things that I really like that we did in the Lourdes were have regular community education gatherings where we sat. I think you had in Britain community schools.
Yes, yeah, supplementary schools.
That exposed some kids to Black history and do they still exist?
I can't speak for London because I grew up in Cornwall, which has a very low Black demographic. But to the best of my knowledge, it doesn't really exist in the same capacity that it did in the 70s and 80s.
Okay, that's sad. Because I know for a fact that those community education sessions made a real difference. And also the establishment of, I don't want to call them charter schools because there's a whole debate here about that, but setting up kind of alternative education for kids in our communities to ensure that if the public schools are not performing adequately in terms of teaching them, that they get that kind of information. Now, I don't know what we're going to do with COVID. You know, whether or not we have schools is going to be an issue. So it's up in the air. But
I wanted to conclude with a quick fire round, which I do with all my guests. And I invite you to complete the sentence. The first one, the greatest misconception about me is
that I'm Puerto Rican or Latina.
My biggest regret is
I don't have any regrets.
I'm most fearful of